Saiva Pratamam Deva
Saiva Pratamam Deva
Komaram Sargamasita
Komaram Sargamasita
Chachara Dushcharam Brahma
Chachara Dushcharam Brahma
Brahmacharyam Akanditam
Brahmacharyam Akanditam.
They were the four unmarried sons of Brahma, the core austerities for realization of the Absolute Truth.
The creation of the material world is affected, maintained, and then again annihilated at certain intervals. So there are different names of the creations in terms of the particular types of Brahma, the father of the living beings. The Kumaras, as above mentioned, appeared in the Kumara creation of the material world, and to teach us the process of Brahman realization, they underwent a severe type of disciplinary action as bachelors. These Kumaras are empowered incarnations. Before executing the severe type of disciplinary system, all of them became qualified devotees. This example suggests that one must first acquire the qualification of Brahmana, not simply by birth, but also by quality, and then one can undergo the process of Brahman realization. In the beginning of the creation, the secondary creation, which is executed by Lord Brahma, the primary creation is executed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who creates the Mahatattva, the basic ingredients of material existence, and then Lord Brahma continues the creation according to a plan revealed within his heart from the Supreme Lord. And Lord Brahma produced sons from his mind. And the purpose of producing these sons was to populate the universe. The four Kumaras, they refused to get involved with these kind of things and decided not to grow up, decided to remain Kumaras, to remain no older than 5 years by their mystic power. And thus they became interesting personalities. They maintained that childish youthfulness of the of five-year-olds, and yet they were great, wise, and self-realized sages. In order to become self-realized, it is pointed out here, first one must become a Brahmana, and then he can realize Brahman. It is stated in the scriptures, Janmanam Jayate Sudra, that by birth everyone is a Sudra. And then sanskarit bhavit dvija, by performing sanskaras, regulated, prescribed duties at certain points in life, one can become twice born. Vedapatit bhavit vipra, by following the path of the Vedas, one can become a vipra, which is a brahmana who is engaged in karmakanda. And then the brahmanas, actually a brahmana janatiti brahman, a Brahmana actually knows Brahman. So in that way, the Brahmana is one who is embodying the mode of goodness. A person in the mode of passion is trying to manipulate the material energy for his enjoyment. And a person in the mode of ignorance is engaging in ghastly type of activities. So from these platforms it's very, very difficult to advance towards the Supreme Lord from ignorance and passion. And generally speaking, it is from goodness that one can approach the Supreme Lord and become steadily situated in devotional service. In this age, there is a special concession, and that concession is there even for those who are in ignorance or those who are in passion, because of the added mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it's also possible to come to devotional service and even to, by that mercy, to carry on. Although it's still difficult when one is afflicted by passion and ignorance to be steady. And that we are finding that steadiness is maybe not the our foremost quality. It's maybe not the most outstanding quality in our movement. That's a fact. We are weak. It is stated austerity is one of the qualities that are broken in the age of Kali. One is, so we do not have much strength to act according to higher knowledge. Acting according to higher knowledge is austerity. But therefore, in Sankirtan, there is very quickly some taste. Not only taste in the musical performance of chanting the holy name, but the higher taste in Sankirtan is the taste of distributing mercy to conditioned souls. And it is that which is a very powerful motivating factor. There's a table here. Food. They're mine. So, in this way, we can, through Sankirtan, become elevated, and we can become selfless because we become preoccupied with the well-being of others, and then it becomes easier to give up our attachment to sense gratification which arises from the lower modes of nature. Somehow or other, either in ignorance or in passion, we are afflicted by desires for sense gratification, and we are trying to fulfill them, either through passion or ignorance. This element of distributing the mercy is truly our only process. Without it, it will be very difficult, because it will be very hard to get situated in the mode of goodness, no matter how much we try. It's the affliction of the lower modes is very deep and goes very far. But when we become very absorbed in distributing the mercy, even if we are not 100% rooted in the practices of goodness and so on, doesn't matter. We can just dovetail our passionate natures and so on in the service of the Lord, and we'll become transcendentally attached, which is ultimately a more powerful means of conquering over material nature. Because even through the mode of goodness, one is not able to really overcome the influence of Maya. It may become easier, but it doesn't really go away. Still, we need some goodness in our life. Basically, in the Bhagavad Gita, we see how there is a description of different types of yoga, like karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. And sometimes one might think that these are referring to different practitioners, different kinds of people, those who are in those who are fruitively inclined, who want to enjoy the fruits of their labor, they can take up karma yoga. Those who are philosophically inclined can take jnana yoga, and those who are more advanced, devotionally inclined, can take up bhakti yoga. That is true, but it is also true that all these three ways are essential for us. We need all of them. Because sometimes we fall short. We just can't stay on the platform of pure devotional service, of serving Krishna out of love. And then we have to come down and serve Krishna out of philosophy, out of jnana, out of understanding, out of just seeing. We have to remind ourselves, this world is all temporary, it actually doesn't make sense to get attached, although we are attached, it doesn't make sense to get attached to anything material. So that's all jnana, cutting. Yet anujasina yukta karma granti nibandhanan, that with the sort of knowledge one has to cut. So that is there, but that's not attraction to Krishna. That's basically that we are using the process of jnana. And then, because we are so rooted in mundane habits, then try and do these activities that we're used to for Krishna. Okay, we love computers, all right, then sit all day behind the computer for Krishna. Although in itself, we are using computers to get rid of computers. We are driving in cars to get rid of cars. And basically, one day, it's back behind the bullocks. That's where it's going. One day, all these machines that are so-called improvement upon the natural arrangements that were made by the Supreme Lord will have to go, because they're actually products of Ugra Karma, a horrible work meant to destroy the world. Or products from the dungeons of the demons. Prabhupada calls the factories the dungeons of the demons. So in that way, we can dovetail. So karma yoga is basically dovetailing. It's basically that what we are already attached to, that what we've already been doing for so long. Purify it now by doing it for Krishna. That's all. And we do all three. We use, we approach Krishna on a pure devotional platform. Whether we have material desires or not, akama sarvakama moksha kama udarati tivrena bhakti yogena yayetu purushamapara. Whether with material desire or without material desire, we're approaching Krishna. And engage in the process of pure devotional service with full force. That we are doing. But also we need sometimes to apply the path of jnana, and other times the path of karma. So like that, therefore we also use varnashram, which is obviously within the realm of karma. It's not transcendental. But we use it because it gives us a code of behavior. It gives us limits. It clearly defines this you can do, that you cannot do, and prescribe duties. So that helps. But in pure bhakti, what is the need of prescribed duty? In pure bhakti, it's simply please Krishna. And that is, of course, the real thing. The four Kumaras, of course, later became devotees. They were initially jnanis. They became devotees and became dedicated to Krishna. So they started out different than we do, because we basically start out immediately with devotional service, and immediately on a high level of devotional service, actually. This movement is immediately functioning on a high level of trying to please Krishna. And then when we cannot do, yes, then over time we learn all kinds of elements of culture. And in the beginning we don't know so much culture, but then after a while, all right, there is a culture that supports devotional service of external behavior, external activity. which we follow, you know, ashram life and so on. In that nectar in devotional service comes only from really turning to Krishna. We may see that the material energy is temporary, okay? And we may appreciate that, and we may learn such kind of philosophy. But that doesn't give you great bliss, you know. The material world is temporary. That's basically a Brahman conception. It doesn't give great bliss, it just gives relief. All right, it's temporary. Good to know. I'm suffering, I can't walk, but it's temporary. Great to know. How temporary? That is temporary, okay, nice. But that's not, relief from suffering can never be the source of true ecstasy. Relief of suffering is only that there is the space to focus on the higher relationship, the source of ecstasy. So that is our business. So this is all preliminary thing. When we are realizing that it's about the eternal reality and not about the temporary, then that's just preliminary. That's not the ultimate aim of Krishna consciousness. Just like in the Bhagavad Gita, the verse Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nakangsatina Sositi, it is said that this stage of Brahma Bhuta, of reaching Brahman, then there is no hankering and no lamenting. Sama sarvasi bhutesu mad bhaktim labhate param. One can become equally disposed towards all living beings in that stage. And then one can take up devotional service to me. That's the essence. It's about that. Okay. So we put the emphasis on that from day one, devotional service, and we want devotional service, we want to serve Krishna, and as much as possible. But then the rest will follow. So I compare it to, we're walking on a tightrope of devotional service. Underneath we have a net, a net of jnana to catch us, a net of philosophy, in case we cannot stay on the tightrope. That's all. But that's why we see that in the Krishna book it's described that in Vrindavan, in the pastimes of Krishna with the gopis and the cowherd boys and so on, the birds in the trees, they were great philosophers in their last life, and they were jumping from one branch to another. They used to be philosophers before. That's kind of nice. Baladev Vichabhusan is also describing how when Krishna and Balaram with their cowherd boy friends are taking their lunches out in the forest and have their picnic lunches, that Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva and the principal demigods, they all take the form of birds and they come and they eat the crumbs that are left over. Yeah. So that's kind of quite amazing to see how exalted this devotional service is, really, in these pastimes. That of Krishna and his childhood pastimes, that seem to be so simple, in a way. Yeah. Just cowherd boys imitating animals. Seems to be a little simple. But we see that these activities are actually the most exalted. So all our sophistication, we have gone beyond the cowherd boy and the young cowherd girl stage. We are now adults, educated, intelligent, and in this way we have become jnanis. Yeah. We have become good jnanis, nicely philosophizing and so on, and our simple, the simple bhakti, just from the heart, yeah, it would be nice and so on, but not so present at the moment. So one must, one hears it sometimes in when Prabhupada speaks and gives a lecture, he speaks about Krishna, you know, like in a very, he says Krishna, the name Krishna, in a very affectionate way. You can see that he thinks that Krishna is very nice. Rupa Goswami is also like that. Rupa Goswami opens up his Hansa Dutta, right, which is a book about separation and how a swan messenger is being sent with a message to Krishna from Vrindavan. The Hansa Dutta messenger is Dutta. Dutti. So, and Hansa is swan. Anyway, in the opening verse, Srila Rupa Goswami says that he is praying that a certain blissful personality may enter into his heart. So it's a nice, it's kind of a nice way to start writing, that a certain blissful personality. We can see that he's meditating on how blissful Krishna is. We don't think like that. Many times for us, we're just so covered by ignorance, we're just thinking, all right, I have to serve Krishna, otherwise I'm going to suffer in the material energy, yes, and Krishna gives me so many rules. And how often do we actually think of Krishna like a nice, blissful personality? It's actually we don't. It's that our attitude has not yet developed as an attitude of appreciating Krishna, of actually seeing him as amazingly blissful Krishna. Everything about him is just the most blissful personality. Everyone's looking for somebody blissful. Like now it's winter, and you know, it gets quiet in the winter. In Mongol Arctic, there's a few people sort of huddled in chadars and sort of softly croaking. It's not like, you know, and it echoes around the big temple, and it's sort of like very, it feels very empty, isn't it? Anybody? Home. But if there's a blissful personality, then suddenly it fills up. When Lokanath Maharaj was doing katha, thousands of devotees here, and no place to park, and because he sings like so blissful, right? So it's a blissful personality, Krishna's pastime, so very sweet. So devotees become blissful personalities by remembering Krishna, and that's what it's all about. To focus on the supreme blissful personality, we become blissful. And then devotional service is a different ball game. Then we're not so relying on philosophy, being philosophical. Because philosophy, the proper understanding must be there. In Vrindavan, next to our temple, there's an ashram of Babaji's, and they're chanting a mantra, which I'm not going to repeat. But it's a little similar to Nitai Gaur Radhasham Jai Krishna Balaram. Slightly And they chant these kinds of concocted mantras. But that's not all. Of course, these mantras are names of Krishna, so what's wrong with it? Well, the thing is that it's not about what's wrong with it, it's about what is right with the Maha Mantra. And in the Maha Mantra, there is a relationship. There is Krishna, the all-attractive Supreme Lord, and the vocative form of Hara, Hare, the Ladini Shakti, the pleasure potency, or pure devotional service embodied by Radharani, but any devotional service, Hare, representing devotional service to Krishna. And then Ram represents either Balaram. So Balaram is the embodiment of ecstasy. Balaram is particularly the one who gives spiritual strength. So that name Ram, meaning Balaram, means yes, there is spiritual strength. Why? Because Ram stands for happiness. Ramanti yogino nante satchinan chatatmani tatvityat atmano mayam. It is the transcendental happiness that is experienced in chanting Hare Krishna or in devotional service to Krishna. Then, so from serving Krishna comes Ram, spiritual strength, ecstasy, and even Lord Ramachandra, who is the embodiment of following religious principles. Then one becomes pure, and then one becomes the embodiment of religious principles. So it's interesting that all these things are there within the name. So, whereas if you chant just different names of the Lord, that relationship is not there. Therefore it cannot compare to the Maha Mantra. But that's not all. That's not the only problem with our neighbors in Vrindavan. The real problem with the neighbors in Vrindavan, when they chant Nitai Gaur, they say that Nitai is Radharani and Gaur is Krishna. So, well, yeah. Then, of course, it's nice they chant Nitai Gaur, but it's not entirely, it's not quite right. So the fool, although they get some taste and some ecstasy, the full ecstasy cannot not be experienced like that. So, tattva is required. We must understand the nature of things. But otherwise, once we've understood the nature of things, we are more interested in pleasing Krishna than in analyzing endless different tattvas. Once we've understood the tattvas, good enough. And because the essence is simply to please Krishna and nothing else. And just like in Sankhya, one tries through Sankhya philosophy to analyze the various material elements and also the Supreme Lord. But ultimately, Prabhupada said Sankhya is the philosophy by which we are figuring out what is the root of the tree. And then bhakti is that we're watering the root of the tree. Yeah. So one has to, after finding out the root of the tree, water it. So our movement is that movement. Immediately water it. Therefore, laziness is a big enemy. Laziness is a symptom of the mode of ignorance. Therefore, Prabhupada used to say things like that the management should make sure that everyone is engaged and the temple is not a free hotel. There's all these kind of instructions that, like, I used to read when I was a manager. I haven't read those things for a long time, but just remembering them today, because someone told me yesterday he was lazy. got inspired. Yeah, those are the symptoms of ignorance. Because in ecstasy, avyakta kalatvam, one doesn't want to waste a second, not a moment, every moment for Krishna. And that's actually nice. So then, let us do that. Like if we want to bring life to a sleepy winter temple, it can only be done by enthusiastic devotional service, only by glorifying Krishna, by only then. Like I have that story that some of you have heard from me, of course, but I'll tell it anyway. That I was in, one winter I was in Estonia, which is one of the Baltic states, and it's extremely cold over there. And there was lots of snow, and they had, with bulldozers, cleared the road. There was like a wall of 2 meters of snow on either side of the road, and it was still snowing like anything. It was coming down. And we were in the car, and the heater was in full blast, and I had also electric heating in the chair, and I was wearing the heaviest winter gear you could wear, and I was not terribly warm, and we're driving deeper and deeper into the snow. So I was expecting polar bears and penguins any moment. And then we were about 3 hours drive from the main city into the snow, and then there were some houses also totally snowed under in a white landscape, and everything totally white, and there's these two houses in the middle of the field. So the car stopped in front of this house, one of the houses, and we got out, and Kay went in the house, and then the man of the house started the Sanskrit stotaram, started to just recite this stotaram, you know, like, I mean, on and on and on, and it's like memorized the whole thing. It was quite something. Then I came inside the house, and there was a life-size replica of Tota Gopinath in Puri. It's a very big deity, you know, it's like enormous deity, right? So they had this enormous replica of Tota Gopinath, this huge deity there on the big altar. And they had a tulsi, which is like thick wooden stem, you know, like a tree. And it's like in the middle of the snow there. It got like, how is this possible? How can they have all this? And then they served a big feast, which, you know, to reciprocate for all the bhakti that obviously was there, okay, I took sumptuous prasada more than I wanted. And then, you know, someone says, now you have to come to my house also. So then we went to the house next door. And they also had a big altar. And they also had a tulsi. And they also had a big feast. And I had to eat that one also. But it was amazing, these two houses, you know, in the middle of like nowhere, right? And as I was there, I realized, if these people can do it, anybody can do it, right? I mean, talking about isolation, you know, after that, right, when you're in a place like that, you know that the earth is flat, and you know that you're on the edge, and that if you go 1 kilometer further, you're going to drop off, you know? I mean, that's how it is, that kind of a place, really. I mean, and these people, they were just absorbed, you know, absorbed. Not just making a show for me, but like memorizing big Sanskrit stotarams, good luck, you know. I mean, when did we do that, you know? So sometimes you dust off an old songbook. I don't know any Sanskrit stotarams. Too lazy. Too much work to memorize them. But these devotees did it. So that's all it takes, you know, like that we do something with enthusiasm. Some people memorize the whole Bhagavad Gita. If you have a bit of memory, why not? Because me, you know, I mean, memory is not my strongest thing, but if you have a bit of memory, why not? The whole Bhagavad Gita can be done. Many devotees have done that over the years. No one told them. They just did it on their own. Yeah? One day they decided, I'm going to memorize the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah? Wasn't that their spiritual master told them, come here and get an instruction for you, memorize the Bhagavad Gita? No. They just decided, well, why not memorize the Gita? Why not? It's a great opulence. Palladananda Swami has this outrageous memory, inconceivable memory, somehow or other, and he remembers like the Krishna book. Yeah? I mean, he can literally, from memory, just recite pages of the Krishna book. It's like reading the books, like a tape recorder. Yeah? He's serious. He also is into astrology. He knows hundreds and hundreds of astrological charts of people by heart. He knows the whole charts. He sees them one time and he knows them. And he's blessed with a very powerful memory and uses it well. So, yeah, something we should do. That's the idea. Avyakta kalatvam, not to waste a moment. That's when we are free from the body. When we think, pooh, so much work, have to chant all these rounds, pooh, have to read verses, pooh, have to get up early, pooh, have to do all this service, you have to clean for Krishna, do preach, all these things you have to do, pooh, that's the mode of ignorance. That's what it is. Anyway, that's our condition. And therefore, devotional service seems to be so difficult. So we have to shake it off by engaging very actively in devotional service with great enthusiasm. Any questions? Leaving today is your last chance. Yeah. Book up a boarding pass.
You mentioned previously that by seeing the world through dhyana, you get conviction. And now you're saying that our focus should be devotional service.
Yeah, I'm talking about climbing up a ladder. See, from the mode of ignorance. Okay, let's go up and let's have more of a philosophical understanding so that we can appreciate that that we can't waste our time with the material energy. We are ksudratma, small-minded people who just forget everything and just look at some small situation, feel, oh, this is so important, oh, yeah. And so our philosophical approach will remind us of the bigger picture, eternity, Krishna eternally there, we eternal spirit souls, eternal servants of Krishna. I mean, it's a step up from the small-mindedness of materialism where we get all under the motes, but it's not enough. Yeah. It's just got to come from actually being like Rupa Goswami. Coming to the point, may a certain blissful person reside within my heart. It has to come to that. I'm always thinking of a blissful person, blissful Krishna. So that's nice. When I read it, it was sort of like, yeah, nice, blissful Krishna. I thought, well, I can take that with me for a while, and just for a while I can walk around and remind myself, blissful Krishna. How blissful is Krishna? Krishna is blissful. Yeah. Until I get dull again, and it doesn't work anymore. Yeah. Then I need some new impulse to sort of shake me in my ignorance, right? In my comfortable position in the mode of ignorance. Warm, cozy, in a lump of flesh, sitting there, thinking that, like, yeah. Is there anything to eat? I'm tired. Like that. Oh God, I have to do all these things. Oh God. Oh God, I have to live. Oh God. Oh God. Like that. All right. If we cannot remember that blissful personality, well, then at least a little philosophy. Eternity! Oh, yeah. Anybody else?
On the liberated platform, how is that?
On the what platform?
Liberated platform.
Liberated platform.
The element of anger manifests.
The element of what? Man?
Anger.
Anger. On the liberated platform, you're talking about the Kumaras? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
That they became angry and they cursed the doorkeepers.
Well, I think that, you know, the anger of the Kumaras is difficult to understand. Obviously, if the Kumaras were completely on the liberated state of Brahmavadis, right, then their anger could not have been personally motivated. Then their anger was of a deeper and much more exalted level. As Brahmanas, they were angry. As Brahmanas, they were angry that the proper channels of mercy were not available due to due to the behavior of these doorkeepers. So they were angry out of compassion, because Brahmins always are full of compassion. So it's a more exalted type of anger than just, you know, they wouldn't let us in. Teach him a lesson. Any question?
I'm talking about anger, Maharaj.
Yeah.
How does one judge for oneself, maybe in others, or at least for oneself, that our or someone else's anger is not personally motivated? We are not on the liberated platform, but the tendency that emotion comes up.
Yeah, you know, like, we have to be very careful with that. Yeah. And because, for example, I have many times been responsible for Prabhupada's facilities in this movement and in various services, and then sometimes I saw that it was being misused or not properly cared for, and then I sometimes became angry, or, you know, but I may have also committed some offenses in the course of that anger, yeah, by being unduly, inappropriately strong with people, and so on. And yeah, one is not, even if one is in management, you know, like, I mean, talking about my own position really, I realize that even if one is in management, one is not saved from reactions to offenses that are committed in the cause of duty. Yeah. So that's scary. In the cause of duty, I'm correcting these devotees because for Prabhupada. Yes. For Prabhupada. I slapped him for Prabhupada. He deserved it. The rascal. I had a rascal, devotee who wanted to drive the Sankirtan van. He had no, the bus, and he had no license at all. And we had a professional driver, but he was a muscle man. So one day, he just threw the driver off the bus, and he started driving the bus himself. And he rolled it, totaled it, totally smashed it to pieces. Yeah? And I didn't become, I didn't lose it. I was reasonable. I spoke with him, explained to him his mistake and how, you know, and so on. I didn't blast him. A few hours later, he's outside beating up a devotee. I came on the spot and lost it. Gave him a serious slap, you know. Well, he just rolled the Sankirtan van, you know. Yeah. I wouldn't do that anymore. Although it was very satisfying at the time. That's okay. That's all right. I think. I think. Ne, vijay to janta hai, to wo karab kar diya, isliye to koi baat. Theek hai. To dusti sambandha hai. Prem se kar diya. Yeah, so... Yeah, that's you know, when I was temple president, then we had a sannyasi staying in a temple in India named Radha Govinda Maharaj, right? And so Radha Govinda Maharaj would come to my room every morning around 6 o'clock at one point, knocks on the door, and just immediately goes on the ground and offers his obeisances. Me also, I'm Grihastha, you know. So I was like, oh, like, Maharaj, please, what are you doing? You know, like, Maharaj, come on, you know. And then he would just go away. Next day, same thing. So after, I don't know how many days, you know, at like one point, so I said, just, Maharaj, please stop this. I said, Maharaj, this is too much, you know. He says, no. No, it is my duty. It is my duty. After all, you are our father. He really got me with that. I never thought of myself as his father, you know? Like, I never thought of myself as, like, the father of everyone in the temple, you know. Okay, temple president, I'm in charge here, you know, I'm the manager, I'm the... But then I was like, the father, you know. It did something to me. And really, he got through to me. I started to change my attitude a little bit and become the father, you know, of everybody. So that little bit of love is helpful. And so punishing devotees is getting angry. You have to be careful with that. Husbands that get angry with their wives, it's a Vaishnavi. Yeah, even there can be Vaishnava apparatus kick in. Even there, when the anger is excessive. So excessive anger can be dangerous. And of course I took it a little bit to my my own example as a manager, and since you also are like a manager, you know, I just, but this anger exists everywhere. Yeah. I saw the little brahmacharini strangling the big fat one. I was surprised. I never thought she had it in her, but she did, you know. No, not on anybody's case, I take it. But I just took this example. I just took this example because it was so unexpected. You know what I'm saying? I didn't think that it would come from that corner. If two kind of rough brahmacharis get in a fist fight, okay, you know. I could kind of expect it, right? Yeah, okay. But, and that we have seen many times also. but that skinny little Mataji going for the big one. But yeah, we've had that. We also had, in Vrindavan, we had a Norwegian, and he was 2 meters tall, a Viking. And then we had a Spanish bhakta named Paco Pacora. and at one point, you know, in India you have the godown, you know, next to the kitchen, the storeroom, the boga room, where everything is, and there is one man who's in charge of the godown. So Paco Pacora was in charge of the godown, and Bjorn stepped over the line. You know, there's a literal line, and no one can step over, and Bjorn stepped over. And then Paco Pacora lost it. He totally lost it, you know. And I was just at that time showing a general around, you know, talking with this general and taking him to the temple and telling him about the nice spiritual atmosphere of the ashram and all these things. And suddenly, you know, this huge guy, 2 meters tall, Viking, comes running with a tiny little Spanish guy with a big stick behind him. Oh, well. So, yeah. It takes all kinds. There's really people with an anger problem. And anger... If we can utilize anger and be angry, and the next moment it's completely gone, right? Completely gone, then it's like Prabhupada's anger. Right? Prabhupada could be like that, you know. When Prabhupada got very angry, his lip would start to quiver, right? And it's like, Navayogendra Swami, he got it, because he put his chadar on the floor, and he put his beads on the chadar. And then Prabhupada said, "Why are you putting your beads on the floor?" And he said, "No, Prabhupada, I'm putting them on the chadar." And then Prabhupada's lips started to quiver, you know, like, and then he just gave him a full blast, yeah. And then Navayogendra Maharaj understood he should not say anything. But then after, Prabhupada completely back to normal, completely. It didn't take him like, you know, I mean, you know, okay, you know, don't start me again, you know. Yeah. And so that's very nice. Some unfortunate devotees, they have to correct others. The fortunate devotees, they can just be more tolerant than a tree and just be friendly and happy to everyone. It's the best.
Sometimes it's like, you know, like when a devotee is angry with you, then you can just say like, I'm going to accept this interaction as just being like part of my purification sometimes, associating with devotees, can be purifying, etc. So if you try not to choose to retaliate in any way,
then
in that way, you're also kind of offending the person, because it's like, you know, I'm upset with you and you're not doing anything, and then...
No.
So is there any kind of safe mechanism?
Walk away.
That we can just...
the walk away mechanism is okay. It's recommended in the Nectar of Devotion. I was also in Vrindavan, temple commander in those days, and I'm walking upstairs in the Gurukul building around the ashram, you know, Brahmacharya ashram, and suddenly one door of a room flies open, and this personality comes out and says with a heavy French accent, you think, you are a big boss, you think you are a big boss, you are nothing. And I never met the guy in my life. No, I never met him in my life, you know. And he was just so vicious, you know. And I was downstairs in my office and totally shocked, you know, just thinking, my God, who was he, you know? And finally I was thinking, well, he must have been the personified reaction of all the offenses I've made to the devotees, you know. God, oh God. I am, you are nothing! Nothing! No, so just walk away. But if the anger is directed to a third person and they're beating up an innocent devotee, then it's something else. At one point in Vrindavan, they had passed there was a new management, and they were taking over, and they put a new temple commander, and they wanted to get rid of the dogs. So he used to beat the dogs. And one night particularly, he beat this dog with a piece of wood, and this dog was just screaming. I couldn't take it anymore. And I just went downstairs, and I just walked up to the guy, and I grabbed that piece of wood from his hands, and I said, and now I'm going to break every bone in your body if you ever dare to lay one finger on it. It's the order of the GBC. I don't care. I'll break every bone. That worked. He never did it again. And I think that day Krishna was smiling upon me. I think so.